Blog Talk Radio.
Stand up, all victims of oppression, for the tyrants fear your might. Don't cling so hard to your possessions, for you have nothing if you have no right. Let racist ignorance be ended, for respect makes the empires fall. Freedom is merely privilege extended, and let's enjoy it by one and all. For the brothers and sisters, for the struggle carries on. He is the national
Kansas. I'm your host, Mike Cadell, broadcasting from North Jefferson County, Kansas. I'm so happy and proud to bring you this special May 1st International Workers' Day 2010 broadcast commemorating the historic newspaper, The Appeal to Reason. That's Billy Bragg's version of the old International. A new generation, he changed the word singing with the Sheffield English Choir, the old International. You'll hear more of it, but we're going to go right on in to Professor John Graham, who edited and wrote large parts of the book, Yours for the Revolution, The Appeal to Reason, 1895-1922. But first, a voice of a new generation.
Hello, I am Tristan Cadell. The following, written in turmoil and economic depression, following the Napoleonic Wars, Shelley's Men of England urged a proletarian revolution. Men of England remains a hymn of the British labor movement. To the Men of England, by Percy Bysshe Shelley. Men of England, wherefore plow for the lords who lay ye low? Wherefore weave with toil and care the rich robes your tyrants wear? Wherefore feed and clothe and save from the cradle to the grave those ungrateful drones who would drain your sweat, nay, drink your blood? Wherefore bees of England forge many a weapon, chain, and scourge, that these stainless drones may spoil the forced produce of your toil? Have ye leisure, comfort, calm, shelter, food, love's gentle balm? Or what is it ye buy so dear with your pain and with your fear? The seed ye sow, another reaps. The wealth ye find, another keeps. The robes ye weave, another wears. The arms ye forge, another bears. Sowed seed, but let no tyrant reap. Find wealth, let no impostor heap. Leave robes, let not the idle wear. Forge arms, and your defense to bear. The following was written in the Appeal to Reason on March 10th, 1917.
If you haven't yet, we're talking with Professor John Graham, who is the editor and wrote the introduction to the University of Nebraska Press book, Yours for the Revolution. One of the few, you know, it's all in one volume. You get the taste of the breadth of the Appeal to Reason, the Kansas Weekly out of Little Girard, Kansas, the Appeal to Reason newspaper that circulated through the 1890s and up to 1920. And it's really an eye-opening period. Listeners, I don't know if you noticed, there's a documentary out called What's off of Thomas Frank's book, What's the Matter with Kansas? It's a documentary of the same name. It'll be playing in Kansas City here soon. And if you do go and check out the documentary, it's by Joe Winston, Joe and Laura Winston. They're the document, the people that produced it. And it's about Kansas. What's the matter with Kansas today? People, it's an amazing book. But anyhow, this movie is coming to play. And there's a significant part of the movie, I think it's at the very beginning, where the author of the book, Thomas Franks, is standing over a small stone. It's a site stone in Little Girard, Kansas, and that's all that's left of the Appeal to Reason physically. And it was, he mentions J.A. Wayland in it. And he comments about the largest socialist newspaper in the history of the United States coming out here, and that there's this desolate area, an empty lot in Girard, and there's this stone, concrete stone of it. Professor Graham,
I'm not familiar with. Yeah. I did trek about in Girard, and there were four different buildings that the Appeal, given its growth, had to occupy. And when, for example, it was turning out weeklies by the millions, they obviously had to move from a smaller to a larger building for the number of people who worked there and the size of the presses that they had. but in any case, yeah, I mean, Girard is, it's been 25 years since I've been there, but it still was more or less as small as it was when the Appeal to Reason was published there. The Appeal actually started in Kansas City, Kansas, rather than Missouri. And then for largely economic reasons, went to a smaller town, and hence to Girard, which then became the center in a number of ways of American socialism.
Mm-hmm.
So your readers or your listeners may enjoy, or not, as the case may be, that part of Kansas history.
Well, I think that's they don't have any choice, and I think in Radio Free Kansas. But I wanted to point out that the book is in memory of J. A. Wayland, who is actually, I guess, the guy that brought it down from Kansas City, Kansas, and planted it in Girard. He wrote, I got a section, and this is again from Yours for the Revolution. It's called A Vision of the Future. I'm going to read just one paragraph, actually, it's one long paragraph, by Julius Augustus Wayland. When I look at the ferment of this insane social system, when I see its corruption, bribery, oppression, suicides, murders, robberies, prostitution, drunkenness, and rapid concentration of wealth, when I see the masses apparently dead asleep to the meaning of their condition or to what it is tending, when I see the little businessmen grow weaker as the greater ones grow stronger, when I see the rulers taking to themselves more and more power while the millions gradually let slip their influence in public affairs, when I see the courts more and more becoming only tools for the rich, while the poor are helpless before the law, when I see the voters losing what little comprehension they had of the purpose of the ballot, using it merely as a means to favor some scheming, cunning, self-seeking friend with a fat place, when I see the great corporations corralling the lands and great tracts, filling the waterways with their own ships, and exploiting the riches of the mines for their kingly self-aggrandizement, I say, when I look over this alleged civilization and see these things, I feel a hopelessness that makes me heartsick, and I wonder if it is worth the struggle, and if life is worth its care, and if annihilation were not a joy. This is some pretty passionate writing, Professor Graham, from a guy talking, describing, I find it ironic, he's describing similar things that are happening today.
Yeah. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And Wayland was an astonishingly fine writer. And I should perhaps also mention that he began as a printer, but before he was a printer, one of my grandfathers was a printer.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, he had a small farm in Massachusetts, and of course it didn't support himself or his family, so he would periodically go to Boston, work at a newspaper. You know, this is Linotype or
mm-hmm.
Linotype or Linotype printing in those days, rather than computerized. He'd work for a month or two in Boston to get enough money to come back to the farm. But in Wayland's case, you know, this almost reminds me of another grandfather. In Wayland's case, cholera swept through the town of his birth, swept through his family, took his father and either four or five of his father's sons into death. And Wayland had to stop school really young, as did that other grandfather of mine, for similar reasons.
Uh-huh.
And Wayland only had two or three years of academic schooling and then was out of it. So
wow.
He was,
I didn't know that.
A very talented guy who taught himself to write and had a talent for writing. So there's some absolutely great writing that Waylon does. It was probably was at least of the officers or the people who worked at the Appeal, he was the best writer.
Uh-huh.
It published from various parts of the United States elsewhere. A number, really a great number of other writers, but Waylon, of those who was located in Girard, was definitively the best writer.
Well, you mentioned, or I believe actually it's a clipping from that you reprinted that was in, that you put in your book. If there's a mention of him as the One Hoss Boss, and there was some, there was a mythology around Waylon, I guess, even at the time. Something about he was called the One Hoss Boss, yet the workers at the printing plant for the Appeal to Reason were. They had democratic offices. They voted themselves into certain parts of managerial positions. Strangely enough, Waylon, from my understanding, is he just the myth is that he just came into town with some gold for that that he made. How did he come to? Can you tell us what is that about? And
yeah. Waylon was, and it's important to talk about the Midwestern sort of center, the heart of the country.
Yeah, they called him
like Kansas,
the One Hoss Boss. I mean, they called him the One Hoss Boss. You know, I mean,
yeah, and that's H O S S.
Right.
Waylon, Penn ultimately moved to Pueblo, Colorado, where he began as another printer and very, very small publisher. And by accident, he became a real estate investor.
Oh, really? Huh.
Yeah. And he bought a property for his own use, and shortly after he bought it, he was offered a couple of $1,000s more for it than he paid. So he thought, well, that's not really a problem. And he sold it.
Right.
This is a very, very simple procedure, being a real estate speculator. And Waylon, in addition to printing jobs and being a editor of a newspaper in Pueblo, then began as a real estate speculator. And he put together in that process, this may not seem like much these days, but $80,000 from just turning over properties. I mean, we're not, when you look at developers and real estate speculators,
uh-huh.
I mean, you're not really talking about intellectual wizards.
It's
a very simple process.
Yes, he seemed to see through that.
But at the same time that this was happening, he became converted to socialism.
So
what happened is he came to the end of things, Pueblo, Colorado, which then was basically the home of Colorado Fuel and Iron,
oh, really?
Coal Company, and Steelworks. And this was a Rockefeller, soon to be a Rockefeller-owned operation, and then shows up as the predominant, as it were, thug in the 1913-1914 Colorado coal strike.
Yeah.
They ran the strike for the coal operators, and Rockefeller owned them.
Yeah.
So,
now, so Wayland was witnessing this in the early boom period as it was starting to develop in Pueblo. And
yeah.
He came back, then he came to Kansas City, Kansas. Then was this before or after this thing, the paper he had his hands in, The Coming Nation?
This was after.
Uh-huh. So
The Coming Nation was also a Wayland paper. And at one point, he believed that if he started a utopian and communitarian little island of like people, it would really prove that cooperation, community, and relations would prove that socialism, at least in a small sphere, was possible. And that proved not to be. There were 100 to 125 utopian communitarians, most of whom had never even met each other. And before moving to Tennessee, where the Coming Nation was going to be the source of income for the socialist community, but things just didn't work out.
Mm-hmm.
Balin left and then continued on. First, I think, to Pueblo, Colorado, and but there could have been a intermediary place.
Yes, I had no idea. I had no idea he'd spent some time in Colorado. That was probably watching the worst of the Industrial Revolution take over the country there. You know, now he was married. I guess he was married, and had five children, and there was tragedy in that vein too, wasn't there?
Yeah, some of their sons and daughters of his sons and daughters were certainly alive when we did, when I did the Appeal to Reason book. And I should probably say, since the phrase "yours for the revolution" might be a little bit surprising, that was the, if you were a socialist, that was the way you signed your letters. You didn't say "yours truly" or "yours sincerely." You wrote "yours for the revolution."
Interesting.
And at various points, I do as well.
Yeah, I confess. I confess that myself as well. But, you know, Wayland, his wife died of cancer. This was, I believe, while he was working. He was publishing in Girard.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, I published some newspapers, and there's this one quote that I think is, I wanted to throw at you, and it's a real short sentence, and I've printed it as a, I don't know what you call it, an epitaph on the flag of my papers. "The great battles of the world have not been fought and won by polished humanity." And he continues, "We are of this great unpolished army, you and I.
And we have no apologies to make.
To offer for either of us."
Right.
"We've done something which the polished fellows refused to do, done something that needed doing, and now the polished fellows are coming. Our literary comrades are getting the highest rates of all writers for their productions, and you, volunteers of the Appeal Army, have made this possible at this time. It's written December 8, 1906, and he ends with, "We know that the future belongs to us." Certainly, there is something prescient in all this that I find inspirational, that I fear many of my fellow Kansans have forgotten. How did J.A. Whalen meet his end?
He suicided. Put a gun in either his mouth or against his head and shot himself.
At his home?
At his home. And that was in, I should remember specifically, but either in 1912, but I think
1912.
And this was, trying to explain somebody's suicide is, I had to write about it, so I did more than quickly ponder it. Trying to explain it is very difficult. He was accused of the most bizarre stuff, and once you have mainstream, which is to say capitalist newspapers, publishing stuff from, for example, the federal government, it puts, for example, he was accused of bringing the Mann Act or something, a 14-year-old girl, impregnating her, then she died in an abortion. The appeal itself was, as usual, being threatened with destruction by the federal government for mailing privileges and its politics. A whole lot of external stuff consolidated at this point. And Whalen, I remember writing that he did not fear death, and he didn't, and had already given so much of his personal life over to socialism. He finally became, I wouldn't say he was pathologically depressed. He became depressed and felt beaten after all of these years of struggling to create a new or a different type of political economy, which is to say socialism, in place of capitalism, and he killed himself. It's one of the, certainly, perhaps, of the literal appeal itself. Working people who couldn't survive, suicided, like millions, literally millions of times during the appeals 25, basically, 30 years of publication. And Whalen did too. I don't know, some of your listeners may be aware of how common it was for American men not to be married, which is to say, the work that was available to them during this industrialized period simply didn't pay enough to support a family. So, I mean, there were all kinds of, as I say, literally millions of Americans wandering the United States in search of a job, as many are doing at the same point in time in 2010.
Yeah. You know, the
I can tell you the husband of one of my daughters doing the same thing right now.
Yeah.
He's out of work.
Sorry to hear that. But you know, now Fred Warren, after Waylon's apparent suicide, Fred Warren ran the paper, continued to run it after that, and it went well into the 1920, I guess, early 20s, didn't it?
He stopped editing the paper shortly after Waylon's death.
I didn't know that. Uh-huh.
And then other editors came on, and ultimately it was bought by a guy from the East, sold by the Waylon family. The guy from the East was Emanuel Julius Haldeman.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And if you're ever in Girard, I can recommend, I don't know if it's still there,
mm-hmm.
because it's been actually a couple of decades since I've been in Girard. But you can go to the Emanuel Julius Haldeman house. And he came from the East Coast to write and do editing of the appeal late in the appeal's life. And he married, there was one banking family in Girard, and he married the heiress of the banking family. So that was the money that was used to buy the appeal to reason.
Uh-huh.
But if you go to his house, what you will see is a run over by the natural biological plant world. You will see an abandoned swimming pool. And if you have read The Great Gatsby, you'll see.
Oh, really?
Just how much decay has occurred from Daniel Julius's wealth from the old days, and maybe it's still there, but maybe the house and the swimming pool, like a bunch of swimming pools these days that were built in, you know, the late, in late years, which have been run over by various insects and rats.
Well, Haldeman, Julius, what's his, Julius Haldeman or whatever, you know, strangely enough, you could go around here to this day, at least, well, about 5 years ago, and you could still talk to people about the Little Blue Book, which seems to be more famous, the Little Blue Book, frankly, among what's left of the collective memory of Kansans is the Little Blue Book, which I guess was sort of vest pocket-sized editions of, for lack of better terms, the Harvard Classics.
Right.
So,
right.
I mean,
yeah, he continued as obviously a printer in Girard, and I don't know for how many years, but really quite a number of years after the appeal died. And again, I should probably mention that the appeal was, you know, one of, you know, pretty large number of left papers and magazines that were destroyed during the, you know, full-out straight repression of left radicalism during World War One.
This is as the rise.
And it's,
go ahead. I'm
and
sorry.
It's and its aftermath. So yeah, Haldeman and Julius continued on for years, and the little blue books. I'm not surprised.
Yeah, it's sort of a hollow remembrance of the real passion and vibrance that J.A. Wayland put into the impetus and the carry of it. I didn't know Frank Warren left, the editor. We play a section by Dr. Whitehead. He talks about Warren, the fighting editor. It's from his book about the period, and I didn't realize Warren left like that. So now, do you think today, with today? Now, I want to give you something. I don't listen to Glenn Beck, but I keep tabs on him. Glenn Beck is.
I've never heard a word, but I know the name.
Oh yes, he's a notorious hardcore right-wing capitalist or propagandist for the capitalist, to use Wayland's words. But Glenn Beck has been recently tracing this period of time, the very time that you and Wayland describe, the 1880s through the 1920s, with great Beck has a tendency to abbreviate history to the point of a bastard on a short string. And what he did was he pointed out that there were a number of depressions, financial collapses of banks and whatnot. They would spike up and down quite dramatically in the economy of America from that same period. And I know, and he, of course, he's doing this to defuse people who are recalling FDR and the period of coming out of the Great Depression of 1929 that they call in the history books. But this period,
World War II.
Yeah, right. Yes, and into World War II. But this period of economic turmoil, do you think that we're in a similar thing? And despite what Glenn Beck says, you know, maybe just laissez-faire capitalism is what we've got again. And I'm sort of wondering what your thoughts are as we look at. You know, you've been around a while now, Professor Graham. You've written us these inspiring words in your introduction and brought out some of the absolute gleaming gems from the old appeal to reason. What do you think of, could you put this in a historical context today? You're retired, so you can say anything you want, I think.
Well, I had the privilege to a point of tenure at a university, so one was to appoint or to some degree permitted to say what one's basically what one's research made one conclude.
Yeah.
But sure, this is another episode.
Well,
the nature of capitalism, it creates the necessity for profit and overproduction. And when overproduction occurs, it fundamentally means that there's not enough purchasing power in the economy, in the society, to buy what gets produced. So there are these recessions and depressions. I'm inclined to think that in the new future, 2010 and 2011, we're going to have yet another drop. So I don't think, for example, any capitalist propagandist, for example, apparently Glenn Beck, can argue that they don't occur. They've always periodically occurred, sometimes at 5 to 7 year intervals. There was a massive one beginning in 1893 for a few years, rather like the one that's going on now. And we should all be aware that regardless of what FDR and his administration accomplished, the only way out of the Great Depression was the economic gearing up for World War II. There was a period in historiography when it was argued that FDR and his policies, just to give you an example or two, the WPA, the Works Progress Administration, employed hundreds of thousands of people paid by the government. There could be people not flourishing, but surviving, and they would bring government dollars to purchase what was being produced. I mean, there has to be purchasing power in the economy. I taught for years in a building on the University of Colorado that was built by the WPA. The road that I live on, which is a road from Boulder into the foothills of the Rocky Mountains, was built by the WPA.
Oh, my goodness.
And there are dollars obviously going out that the Obama administration is hoping that will make their way to the people, into the population. The difficulty with that, what the Obama administration, for example, is doing, is the money is going to the banks.
Mm-hmm.
And the presumption was that the banks would lend. What, of course, they have not done to any sufficient degree is lend. They have used the money from taxpayers to speculate on various derivatives, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And that money has not made its way down into the population.
Oh boy.
Nobody who's a serious economist really believes in trickle-down economics.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It doesn't trickle down. And the Obama administration, like the Bush administration, or like the Reagan administration, is proving that once again. So things now will not go well.
Yeah.
Economically.
Yeah, you know, the that I find that an interesting agreement with you, because now you find radio stations in Topeka setting up pothole websites to find the biggest potholes to avoid on the street, the capital city of Topeka, Kansas. Radio, where you can do a search before you go out on your work, not to drive in any potholes. Speaking of the WPA road out of your place, and there were 1,200 people just this last week, and I don't want to date the interview, but in Lawrence, Kansas, marching to save their neighborhood public schools when they shut down the main street through Lawrence, Massachusetts, down for about an hour and a half as they paraded for about four blocks and rallied. So, I find it remarkable.
Lawrence, Kansas or Lawrence, Massachusetts?
Lawrence, Kansas. Lawrence, Kansas happened just two Saturdays ago. So I see this, I hear you talking about this stuff in this historical, this historical context of where we're at today, and I can't help but think of these tea parties, and I know that's push, I don't know if you've watched or heard them, I know that they were all over the so-called town hall meetings. This seems to, it seems to be some sort of a mass movement, but it's well funded by the Koch brothers out of Wichita, Kansas, an oil empire, and other notable so-called libertarian millionaires. I'm surprised Alan Greenspan, the former chairman of the SEC, former chairman, didn't Federal Reserve chairman Alan Greenspan didn't give millions of dollars to spawn this these so-called mass movements. But it seems to be a discernible right-wing type conservative backlash against the Obama administration, and it doesn't fare well for people who can remember or have written about, as you have, these popular mass outrages against the bankers that was occurring from the 1890s to 1920s. I mean, it's sort of an interesting historical context. How do you view that?
This is a really odd phenomenon. I read about it, but there doesn't seem to be, in other words, people respect it because it's one sign of outrage at, to say it directly, it's one sign of outrage at the excesses and catastrophes of American capital. But they don't have, the Tea Party people don't have anything like what could be considered a responsible analysis. Their descriptions of Obama as a socialist, their descriptions of him as a communist and a fascist, none of those, they all contain so many contradictions that there's no way to make them confirm or have any sense. Rather than talk about that, what I think is the most important thing to talk about is one of the fundamental principles of American socialism and its conflict with American capitalism. One doesn't really need to go to Marx, one can go to Abraham Lincoln, one can go to David Ricardo, one can go to the hero of American capitalism philosophy, Adam Smith and the Wealth of Nations. All of them believed in what's called the labor theory of value. And a good way to explain that, and I've often done this as it's arisen at, in a university class, is to quote Andrew Carnegie, who came as a basically impoverished Scots person to the United States and amassed a fortune from the Carnegie Iron Works and a much greater fortune when it was sold to J.P. Morgan and it became U.S. Steel. And Carnegie's quote reveals, very short quote, it reveals a huge amount And it's also included in the Appeal to Reason. And this is the quote: "The greatest discovery of my life is that the men who do the work never become rich." I used to pause after that in the class to watch the responses. And if you were a well-propagandized, you'd look at either or the quote as though it just came from an airship from Mars or Jupiter. In other words, you're taught to believe that you're going to succeed by hard work. There was always another element in class who, you know, when questioned, couldn't understand when or couldn't remember when they learned that. It was like they got it with their oatmeal and eggs.
Mm-hmm.
It was just natural. But no, the way you make money, the way you become rich, is owning where others work or live. If, for example, you own apartment buildings or office space or malls or whatever. But you don't become rich by working. So then you have to understand or begin inquiring why you don't become rich by working. And if you think about it, nobody will hire you unless your work creates a profit for them. There is no such thing in American capitalism as a fair wage. People do not get paid in direct proportion to the value that they create. If they did, there would be no profit coming out the other end. So when you go in a store, as everybody goes in a store sooner or later, you know, you will see salespeople, people stocking shelves. They are, in effect, paying their employer to work there. I wrote in the article that in the Prince for the Revolution book, that normally what happens is, you know, for every day or two you work, you get paid for your work during that week. For the remainder of the days that you work, you don't get paid at all. The value of those other days is just taken by your employer. What you'll find is, for example, Yours for the Revolution, is Whalen writing, using United States federal statistics, I've read them as well, that what that average worker at that point received was 17% of the value that he produced. 17%. So that's whatever it is.
That's
a five-day week work week. Not even one full day.
That's a dirty little secret is what that is.
Right. And that is the nature of capitalism. If there's profit coming out the other end, and capitalists don't start businesses unless they want to make profit. You can't pay people for the full value of their intellectual and physical labor. Wayland and other people compared it unfavorably, as it happens, to serfage when there were serfs in the Middle Ages in Europe.
You mean like the feudal lords with their castles?
Exactly. Which is to say, during those days, and we know this, a serf worked for his landlord, the lord of the land, 2 or 3 days a week and no more, nor were there other profits or taxes taken from his work. The other 4 or 5 days, he worked for himself. In other words, he grew grain, food, tended to stock. He only had to work of those 7 days a week, let's say 2.5 days on average. During the 1919 steel strike, just a massive strike, like the Colorado coal strike, one of the best investigated strikes by the federal government, with all kinds of documents available. The steel workers were working 69-hour weeks, 69 hours. Mm-hmm. So maybe somewhere in Kansas, people either have on the back of their car or will see it on the back of somebody else's car, a bumper sticker about supporting unionism and supporting unions, which is to say, the bumper sticker says, these are the people who brought you weekends. It's true. Weekend of leisure only came after decades and decades, well more than 50 years, of struggle. I might also say about current conditions, as looking at the Appeal to Reason book last night, what the Obama administration is seeking to do, but it will fail to do because of the Republican Party, is to create another stimulus package, which is to say, to pump money from the federal government, from taxpayers, into the economy. This is, just let me read a few things. This
sure.
is the Socialist Party platform from 1908. And at that point, 1907, 1908, there was a very, compared to what's occurring now, a very minor, very, very minor depression going on. Depression, recession.
Mm-hmm.
So, what did they say to be done? They say, the immediate government relief of unemployed workers by building schools, by reforesting cutover wastelands, by reclamation of arid tracts, building canals, and by extending all other useful public works. This is where Roosevelt, you know, people talk about the socialist demands and principles that, to one degree or another, have been incorporated into American public life. 1908, they're describing the Works Progress Administration. All persons employed on such work shall be employed directly by the government under an 8-hour work day and at the prevailing union wages. If anybody listening has read about the 1930s, when the Roosevelt administration and WPA, just as one federal work project occurred, wasn't the only one, what private employers were despairing about, what they argued against, was anything like union wages. They did not want the government paying anything like a living wage. They wanted an exploited wage. And this was one of the major Chamber of Commerce Republican capitalist demands. Looking further into this 1908, this is like 100 years
ago. Yeah, right.
This was one of the party's industrial demands. By abolishing official charity and substituting in its place, imagine this, compulsory insurance against unemployment, illness, accidents, invalidism, old age, and death. So, you know, here we have Social Security,
right.
We have unemployment insurance. 1908, you know, one of the other socialist demands was my mind is momentarily popped in blank. Oh, but I remember. One of the other socialist demands was a graduated income tax.
Yeah, that's right.
1908, there was no individual income tax. I think that comes in 1913. People might wonder about the 19th Amendment, which gives women, for example, the right to vote. Do you think either the Democratic Party or the Republican Party favored that? There was only one party that organized around having women to vote. You know, it was the Socialist Party.
And that was before, well before, I think it was in the 1920s when women finally did win the right to vote in America.
I think it was maybe 1921.
Yeah.
Something like that. But, I mean, you can't, what is Ralph Nader's term that some of us can remember? He remembers, you know, being asked, why a third party?
Yeah.
Well, there'd be no real reason for a third one if there was anything like a real second one. Which is to say, you know, his term was the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, two wings of the same soiled capitalist bird.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can't look for either of them. Both of them are capitalist parties. You can't look for either of them to bring progress or more freedom for people.
I hope that we can look towards them to at least defend what feed social benefits we have now available to us and that are quickly being eroded. My brother informed me, he's employed, but he informed me that now an additional penalty for collecting your unemployment insurance now is that you have to bring your personnel file complete with any reprimands that you may have had before to the unemployment insurance council offices. And before, they just penalized you a few weeks extra before you could collect your unemployment insurance checks. Now they want to know precisely if you're, in their books or in their minds, employable. Professor Graham, thank you so much for visiting with me today.
And if you're not employable, it's because you have a bad attitude.
Yeah, right. Which
and you need an attitude adjustment.
Right, which you can be reprimanded over, your attitude.
Right.
So. Reprimanded over. Well, Professor Graham, it's been a joy to talk to you. Now, listeners, this is Yours for the Revolution. It's still available through Bolerium Books, Bolerium, through Amazon. And we've been speaking today with Professor John Graham, Professor Emeritus, tenured out of the University of Colorado. The outstanding book, and it's a cherished possession on my, and shall remain so on my bookshelves. Thank you, Professor.
Yeah, I may just make a comment that if you are interested in American history, particularly at this period of time, and I mean, I passed through 120 credits as an undergraduate, another 72 credits and as a graduate student. And I can assure you, like many of you, there were really important dimensions of American history which were not even touched upon, much less discussed, nor were we assigned reading about. It's a very selective procedure, American education, you know, which is not to say that's not true of other countries as well.
About the savages, you can say you have a better way to live. You can call it manifest destiny. You can talk of all your civilization will give. You can say that we're a thing of history, and progress is the future you will give. You can send your armies to these mountains. You can say we'll prosper beneath your king. But there will always next battle will always be near. As long as you have everything, there will be those who have nothing to fear. And little by little, or maybe all at once, you will lose, because our future is not yours to choose. You can say you've got to stop the communists. You can say that our ideals can't succeed. You can say that competition is the only way, and a global system based on greed. You can call yourself a Democrat. You can call yourself whatever you will. You can keep on stamping out the fires you start, so you may stay on top of the hill. There will always be next battle will always be near. As long as you have everything, there will be those who have nothing to fear. And little by little, or maybe all at once, you will lose, because our future is not yours to choose. Are terrorists. Madmen bent on destroying all that's free. You can say that we are building weapons as your bombers fly from sea to bloody sea. You can say you're with us or against us, and to die quietly is what we now must do. You can maintain your innocence. You can claim that you are many as you represent the few. But there will always be the next battle will always be near. As long as you have everything, there will be those who have nothing to fear. And little by little, or maybe all at once, you will lose, because our future is not yours to choose.
David Robbins. Many thanks to Professor John Graham for donating his time to Radio Free Kansas. This is certainly one to be downloaded and shared with your friends. I can't encourage you enough to let us know. Get it out there. That's what it's all about. We'll take callers and play music. On the chat line, I seldom open a chat line. I really don't know how to run it and run the show at the same time. We'll take callers, and the chat line is open. You're too bashful. I have a couple neighbors who came over to listen to the special show today. But if you want to call in and give your May Day messages and tell us what's going on in your area, I'll be more than happy. I'm going to play another song. We got a caller on right now, but I'm going to play one more by David Robbins, one that really gets to me. I mean, it's just one of those, makes me want to, why I do what I do, why we do what we do, why people keep fighting, why we...
I could never forget how reality came down around us like some Western movie set. And when the dust all settled, the sun shone so bright, and a great calm took over us like it was all gonna be all right. That's how it felt to be alive after the revolution. From Groton to Tacoma, on many a factory floor, the workers talked of solidarity, and they refused to build weapons of war. No more will we make missiles, we're gonna do something different. And for the first time, their children were proud of their parents. Somewhere in Gaza, a little boy smiled and cried after the revolution. Mothers hugged their sons. The Liberty Bell was ringing when the cops put down their guns. A million innocent people lit up in the springtime air. And Mumia and Leonard and Sarah Jane Olson took a walk in Tompkins Square. And they talked about what they do now after the revolution. Debts were all forgiven in all the neo-colonies. Soldiers left their bases, went back to their families. A non-aggression treaty was signed with every sovereign state. All the terrorist groups disbanded with no empire left to keep. And they all started planting olive trees after the revolution. Their plans for global domination were preemptively cut short. Their weapons of mass destruction were inspected and destroyed. Battleships dismantled, never again to be deployed. And the world breathed a sigh of relief after the revolution. Solar panels were on the rooftops, trains upon the tracks, organic food was in the markets, no GMOs upon the racks. and all the billionaires had to learn how to share. Bill Gates was told to quit his whining when he said it wasn't fair. And his mansion became a collective farm after the revolution. All the political poets couldn't think of what to say, so they all decided to live life for today. I spent a few years catching up with all my friends and lovers, sleeping till 11 home beneath the covers. And I learned how to play the accordion after the revolution.
David Robich playing live.
Well, I'm going to do one more song, and I'd like to thank you all so much for coming. It's been a lot of fun, and thanks so much to Susan and AC. And
this is live. That was live, and it's available free on the Internet Archive, internetarchive.org, or go to davidrovich.com. That's Robich. I believe it's R-O-V-I-C-S, David Robich, one of my favorite troubadour musicians that I've ever ran into in my whole life and listened to. I guess I haven't really ran into him face-to-face like I have now. You know, I'm going to bring him on. This is Rabble Rouser, and Michael Franklin is his real name. How are you doing, Michael?
I'm doing all right, brother. How are you?
I'm doing it up front.
Who are you working for, giving him my real name? Who are you working for, huh?
I'm working for the reality, brother. That's what it's going on. How you? A great May Day, May 1st, International Workers' Day, 2010. It is great to be alive.
Absolutely, one of the greatest anarchist holidays that we have as well.
It's unfortunate we lost Howard Zinn this year, isn't it?
I was thinking that myself this morning. That first May Day without. Without Comrade Zinn to do something fun with, you know, it's a shame, but you know, there's a lot of other people out there too that are still working and fighting hard, and I think that you know Howard would take the route of Joe Hill when he says, you know, don't mourn, organize, you know, spend.
Well, it's not in Kansas, not in Kansas, brother. We're sort of the Marines or the Red Guard or the Black and Red Guard. Out here, it's a lonesome duty, I'll tell you. And I really can't impress upon you to understand the significance of the appeal to reason and restoring the legacy of the appeal to reason. I know you have probably some minor disagreements, but as an act of solidarity, I do play a lot of Utah Phillips last night on the first volume, and I'm playing the IWW icon, brother, comrade, Utah Phillips today, as well as other local brothers. What's going on with you? What are your thoughts on May 1st, 2010?
You know, this is going to be an interesting day today. Thanks in no small part to Arizona once again coming forth as the true Dixie of the lower 48. You know, putting forth completely racist bills such as this S-1070 bill. I'm sure you've been seeing a little bit about this, but I can guarantee that that's a focal point for a lot of the marches today. See, what a lot of people don't know about May Day is the history of it, not just in this country, but in countries surrounding us, such as Mexico. Children as young as 5 years old learn about the Haymarket Affair, and there's statues in Mexico City of the Haymarket Martyrs. These are celebrated causes, specifically in Mexico, but in other countries as well. Germany has a great tradition of having a really raucous May Day celebration in Berlin. London generally has good May Day actions taking place. I'm sure that Athens this year is going to be a riot, no pun intended. But coming from Mexico, the workers struggle, you know, dating back before Cesar Chavez, but, you know, going back to Zapata and even before that, the workers struggle in Mexico has been long and hard fought. And these comrades truly do recognize two things that we don't recognize in this country. One, that they're human and that they deserve better. And two, that the land deserves better. So the jobs that they're fighting for, they generally, when they organize, part of their call is to recognize the importance of the land base as well, which is always left out of major reporting, but it is part of their focus. So they're environmentalists as well as union activists, which is a hard fight to get these days, as some people are fighting for labor and for the environment at the same time. The IWW has always been really good at that. But this year is going to be really interesting, I think, because of this new bill that's passed that will force cops to determine the immigration status of every person that they see on the street, basically. They're going to be asking for your papers if you have brown skin living in Arizona. So this kind of fascist regime is going to be met with resistance, and it's going to be met hard. And I think that this day today is going to kick that off. I'm hopeful that today is going to kick that off. I'm hopeful to see some reports of our comrades in Phoenix and in Tucson really getting out there and causing a stir, as well as our comrades in Prescott, Arizona, and Flagstaff. There's a lot of anarchist collectives all around Arizona and in California, and Portland is doing its best lately to bring the insurrection on a large scale here. It's been doing really good. A lot of fighting back against corrupt cops in the streets. The Mayday Coalition here has actually brought that into their demands for their march today is accountability on the police force, no more killer cops. And we'll see what happens.
That's right. And it's always interesting to see the number of demonstrations around the world that occur, especially here in America. I wanted to inform you the reactionary pus of the fascist, the law written in Arizona, was largely authored by a guy named Chris Kobach, who's former chairman of the Kansas Republican Party, currently a law professor in a Kansas City university. He is renowned as being a powerhouse. He actually wrote, helped write the law, got paid thousands of dollars for it, to write the law against the Latino brothers and sisters in Arizona. Did you know that?
No, Kansas City University in Kansas City, Missouri, right there across the line from you guys.
I'm not sure. He wrote it. It's come out in the local press that he was amply paid for this to the tune of $300 an hour from Kansas. Paid for his travel expenses and time there in Arizona to write that law. That's the pus.
I would then quote the Utah Phillips in this case, and I would say the world's not dying, she's being killed, and those killing her have names and addresses, and that could easily be said for the species of this world, including humans. And so it seems that if there is a clear-cut enemy out there, well, people like this fella right here deserves a phone call or a letter.
His name's Chris Kobach, K-R-I-S. Here's how it's spelled, his last name, K-O-B-A-C-H, Google, listeners. You know how to Google. We have class inmates. Unfortunately, here in Kansas, there's so many of them involved that, I mean, we have Sarah Palin coming in here today and tomorrow in Wichita at a 15,000-seat convention center to raise money for a private religious school there. Yeah, this is the kind of pus, this infectious reactionary, as you call it, fascist flavor that we have emanating out of our state. It's a real battle out here. And while we mark them, they're marking us, brother. And
I believe you 100%. The thing is, this is everywhere. Where I live in Oregon is actually the capital, the United States Capitol, or the center point of the white supremacist movement. And so in the town that I live in is the staging point for and the gathering point and headquarters of the largest white supremacist movement in the country. It dwarfs the KKK by far.
Wow.
The National Front is located here. There's about six Aryan Nation affiliated organizations here, and you know, lately there's been a rash of beatings of gay men who get followed home from the bar and are beaten to near death at their homes. There's been a homicide attempt in downtown Portland of an anti-racist action activist was shot outside of a bar in a targeted assassination attempt. And the police here are doing nothing about these actions. So what we're seeing here is we're across the country we're seeing a rise in this this radical right wing crap that's just popping up everywhere. And you know, people, they're being assisted by state legislation. They're being assisted by police. They're being assisted by even the Democrats who are creating the environment for this to foster into something greater than it is. So people need to understand that the enemy is not just you know, just J.H. Blair or Don Massey or anybody like that anymore. The enemy is far and wide, and it's sunken itself into every institution that we see coming out of the system. So you know, I would encourage people to remember the worker struggle, yes, but maybe branch into something new. Learn about a new form of resistance today on this May Day. Make it a point to study something that's happening. Make it a point to learn why Hudson Bay Company's windows were smashed in Vancouver during the Olympics. Research that. Research Hudson Bay Company and see what they're about. Make it a point to learn about the tar sands. Make it a point to learn about the Salish. Make it a point to learn about the Dene and the O'odham in Arizona. Make it a point to learn about these things today. To learn about a resistance that maybe you didn't know about before, because that's what today's all about, is unifying the struggle, solidarity, and resistance.
Right on, brother, and thank you for calling in. You know, I've got another caller on the line. You just drop it. He'll call back here. You know, we disagree on several things, but yes, May 1st is a day of resistance, as always should be, and a day of celebration. Listeners, we need to have our days. The Haymarket Affair started in 1886 over the eight-hour workday and brought a powerful movement against child labor. And I think that's where it started here in the United States, and it's spread all over the world. You got one last parting shot over the bow there, Brother Michael?
Oh, nothing I can say in kind company.
Well, thank you for calling Kansas. Thank you for calling my show, Radio Free Kansas. And,
oh, absolutely, brother. Thanks for doing what you do.
Thank you. Thank you, brother. We'll get back to some more music now. And I wanted to let you know, callers, you're welcome to call in again. Some of you called in with your May Day messages, and we'll talk about whatever you want to talk about when it comes to celebrating International Workers' Day. Thank you so much, Michael Franklin. This is, you know, to go into the international aspects of what the Appeal to Reason was riding on in the early years of the 20th century. Here is a song about an old group from Scotland. Alistair Hewlett wrote this song and played it. It's called, I played an abbreviated version of it last night closing the show. This is Alistair Hewlett. Now that's Hewlett, the Red Clydesiders, and call in if you want.
Jimmy Maxson, James McDiddle, Bob Fertilliger and McShane, Agnes Dolan, Helen Crawford, up with the meat, great John McLean. These are some of the Red Clydesiders, hundreds more I'd wish to name. A monument and raise forever, these are the flower of Scotland's fame. McDougal fell apart in prison, came back with the broken shell. He did the same to young John Muir, 8 like months in the jaws of hell. His only crime was saying no to slaughter in the rich man's war. Property is fixed, he said, don't die for what you can't live for. Thanks and thanks for common folk, himself for money lender. The old church pew, the white and blue, the cult and the young pretender. Keep us swear, but what makes them fear? It's what red and the red wine ciders. Every Sunday night at Bath Street, John McLean roared to Fishfield. Thousands gathered round to hear him. He spake loud and he spake well. 15 years I've been a soldier, fighting far in the cause, he said. I'll not stop now, though you might jail me. Prison walls at any dread. John was lifted for sedition. Muir and Gaelic are mashed in two. Ah, the leader so red twice, I trotted out for public view. While others fled and begged for mercy, John threw caution to the wind. You stand accused, he told the judge, with the blood of millions on your hands. Rags and tags were common form, silver money lender. The old church pew, the white and blue, the kilt and the young pretender. Keep us swear, but what makes them fear? It's what's red in the red wine ciders. Torture by the screws in prison, force-fed with the poison food. Haunted, shattered, still not broken, up on the kirk he proudly stood. That night when John Jane came to Glasgow, weak of body, white of hair, red flag burned as bright as midday. Then the tanks rolled through the square. Workers' blood splashed over the flagstones. Soldiers came with tanks and guns. Beats were broken, spirits too. The final chapter had begun. That treachery on Bloody Friday sent a stench to Heaven's Gate. John said we'll build our own republic. The fight for justice can't wait. Rags and tags were common form, silver money lenders. The old church pew, the white and blue, the kilt and the young pretender. Keep us swear, but what makes them fear? It's what's tied in the red wine ciders. Barbara Gallagher and McShane, Agnes Nolan, Helen Crawford, hundreds more I'd wish to name. Above them all, by heathen shoulder, stood the Dominie by the shores. John McLean, the pride of Glasgow, he gave his life for the common cause. Rags and tags for common folk, silver money lender. The old church pew, the white and blue, the kilt and the young pretender. Keep us swear, but what makes them fear? It's what's red in the red wine cider.
We still have a scheduled caller coming in. Oh, here we go, and I'm going to put him on air. And another Mayday message, I think. Hello, you're on air. Welcome to Radio Free Kansas, brother.
Happy May Day to you, brother. How are you today?
Fine. We're going to go out this afternoon and party and replay Professor John Graham's stuff and fit in a little bit of Fred Whitehead here after your message. And, hey, brother, tell me what you think.
Well, first of all, in honor of May Day, I am not working today, working on anything.
Good for you.
Much to my wife's chagrin, but, you know, what always gets me about today is that the original strife was for safer working conditions, obviously, but also for the 8-hour workday. And I don't know many people who actually have an 8-hour workday or 5-hour work week. Most of the brothers and sisters I know work 10 hours a day or two jobs, 40 hours a piece. So they have, you know, an 8 hour and a half day every day. So I just chuckle that people always, when I mention May Day and how this is one of my favorite holidays, don't realize it actually is originally an American holiday.
Yeah, it started here. Yeah, 1886,
right.
May Market, Chicago.
In Chicago, yeah.
Yeah.
I always go out, you know, on the IWW's
page and read the origins of May Day every year. I just noticed today that Starbucks baristas are organizing and actually have made a Starbucks workers union through the IWW. Since 2004, I guess it started in New York City, but that's interesting. Fighting for safer working conditions at Starbucks. I didn't realize it was a dangerous place to work, but.
Well, I think it's probably, they probably working for peanuts, and they got smart and organized a union. You know, there's a lot of workers out here in Kansas. There's a lot of workers, I guess, being incinerated in the Gulf of Mexico on oil rigs, and coal miners, you know.
Getting trapped in mines.
Mines. You know, the struggle, it's not just dangerous working conditions, but that seems to polarize. That seems to get the attention of the American workers nowadays, and it is this constant drag. You know, not to be too light about this, because I'm getting ready to celebrate this afternoon myself, but, you know, I watched The Office, the movie, the TV show The Office, and I know a lot of people are going to laugh, all right, you know what I mean?
I'm already laughing.
because the guy who runs The Office, played by, I think his name is Michael Collins or Caller or whatever, the guy, that's a spinoff from a British TV series.
Yeah, I've seen the British series also.
Oh, I haven't, but what I'm trying to say is that here you have a dolting idiot who has good intentions, and it's only when the workers in the office begin to move that together that they're able to sort of, like, you know, correct his behavior, you know? And I think that
right.
in my... You know, I think that's hilarious, and the way they do it is hilarious. And maybe we should sort of look that to our future, or how we're at and where our situations are individually, and maybe make a union, a silent union or something, and to sort of, maybe we do that anyhow. What do you think?
What kind of union?
A silent union.
A silent union.
Yes, the workers are. Yeah, they can actually predict what your boss is going to do, and they in Kansas, the conditions are so repressive. Maybe we need to learn how to organize in a way where we control the workplace, and they don't even know it. And you know, I wanted to ask you something. We share friends.
I can't get the comment earlier from your speaker where no one gets paid enough. No one gets paid what they're worth, or else there wouldn't be profits. I mean, I've, you know, always said, you know, all value is derived through labor, been a firm believer in that, but to come out and just say no one gets paid their value is just, or else there wouldn't be profit, is just awesome.
Well, you know,
it's right
been
to the heart of it. I mean, I can't go to work Monday with the same look on my face.
You and I have been friends for decades, and that's been one of our catch slogans, hasn't it? Without labor,
absolutely.
There's nothing. Yeah.
Absolutely.
You know,
back when we were printing the Alternative Index in Westmoreland, and we all signed up as union members and paid our union dues to the IWW.
Right, that one. That's wild.
Yeah.
You know, life is short, isn't it, brother?
Yes, sir. And, you know, Brother Dean, I was thinking of him today. This is always one of his favorite holidays. And
Howard
really
Zinn.
Probably, huh?
We've lost a whole bunch of them this year. It was a hard winter.
Howard Zinn, yep.
You know, and much to the chagrin of Michael Franklin, who, you know, in all respect, thank you, and he's very good at history, but, you know, I lost a cop friend of mine named John McRoy, who worked with the Political Intelligence Unit of the Kansas Bureau of Investigation, who really helped me. Who really helped me when no one else would in Kansas, and to protect the abortion providers here in Kansas. I was working as a private detective, and now my wife, and many of the nurses that she worked for, and the clinics that we worked at. I think that's the dialectic problem we have with people who just automatically label anybody rich or anybody with a badge or anybody in a uniform as a class enemy. I think that's one of my main disagreements with as a whole, that they don't realize that until the soldiers and the cops and the people, even some of the rich, come over to our side, we're not going to win shit, you know? And you know, it's May Day, brother, and I don't want to get down and out, but I wanted to let you know I appreciate you calling it.
It's great to celebrate, and I'm going to celebrate today, but it's good to remember, and like Mr. Franklin was saying, you know, that today is the time to rededicate oneself to whatever the cause may be. It may be, put it as simply as deleting his Facebook account.
Well, it might be. Without labor, there is nothing, and we need to appreciate that, no matter who's laboring, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, we gonna hang on for a little bit? I'm gonna play our brother, the Blade.
I'm gonna listen to the rest of the show, absolutely. And
hang on, brother. We only got about 18 minutes, and I want to get the Blade on. Be sure and tell him I went out of the way and played this. Hold on, brother.
We'll do.
Hello, this is William Theobald reading for Radio Free Kansas. Following is an excerpt from the book Yours for the Revolution, written by Eugene V. Debs, entitled When Shall I Fight? Since my characterization of the soldier in the Jingo edition, I have been asked if I was opposed to all war and if I would refuse to be a soldier and fight under any circumstance, and to make my answer through the appeal to reason. No, I'm not opposed to all war, nor am I opposed to fighting under all circumstances, and any declaration to the contrary would disqualify me as a revolutionist. When I say I'm opposed to war, I mean the ruling war class. For the ruling class is the only class that makes war. It matters not to me whether this war can be offensive or defensive, or what other lying excuse may be invented for it. I'm opposed to it, and I would be shot for treason before I would enter into such a war. If I were in Congress, I would be shot before I would vote a dollar for such a war. Capitalist wars for capitalist conquest and capitalist plunder must be fought by the capitalists themselves, so far as I am concerned. And upon that question, there can be no compromise and no misunderstanding as to my position. I have no country to fight for. My country is my earth. I am a citizen of the world. I would not violate my principles for God, much less for a crazy Kaiser, a savage czar, a degenerate king, or a gang of pot-bellied parasites. But while I may not drop a blood to shed for the oppressors of the working class and the robbing of the poor, the thieves and the looters, the brigands and the murderers, whose debauched misrule is the crime of ages, I have heart full to shed for the victims when it shall be needed in the war for their liberation. I am not a capitalist soldier.
This is Fred Whitehead signing on again for Radio Free Kansas. Today I want to read a lead article for an issue of my now defunct newsletter called People's Culture that was published in the year 2004. I've long been interested in the utopian communities of the United States and elsewhere, actually. We've all heard of the Shakers, and we know probably something about their furniture, maybe even about their music. But there were hundreds of communities like the Shakers scattered around the country. And this is a kind of meditation on the meaning of those communities in a kind of enduring sense in American heritage. The essay is called Somewhere in America, Our Communal Heritage. A few years ago, I went over to the University of Kansas to hear a talk by some Yugoslavian professor who was offering a sort of overview of modern political theories that he thought relevant to our circumstances today. He seemed to have an exaggerated estimate of pragmatism and furthermore dismissed utopian ideas altogether. I couldn't help but query him and to ask if we dismissed utopias outright, how would we be able to really change anything in what presently existed? Professor-like, he dismissed the question as irrelevant, a relic of outmoded thinking. I thought at the time, if he was the best that Yugoslavia had to offer, they were in real trouble. One of the classic discussions is Engels' small book, Socialism, Utopian, and Scientific, which more or less dismisses the utopians as impractical middle-class dreamers. The scientific variety, by contrast, aimed not at constructing an Eden in some small corner of the world, but focused on the transformation of entire societies. I remember talking about Engels' views with the late Truman Nelson. A self-defined, unrepentant Marxist who in the 1950s undertook a defense of the utopian tradition in his novel Passion by the Brook. Truman said that Engels had badly misled him for years because unless you try socialism in a place, you will never know if it will work. That is, the small-scale experiments were essential toward the creation of a new society. Truman still resolutely defended a wholesale revolution. You can see the Truman Nelson reader in paperback from the University of Massachusetts Press. But he had a strong feeling for all those who went about the work of putting their beliefs into concrete practice wherever they were. Of course, there was a tremendous variety of such experiments, hundreds of them in the United States alone at the high point in the mid-19th century. They included the Shakers, who built large-scale agricultural and small industrial communities in New England and as far south as central Kentucky. The Amana colonies in eastern Iowa were founded by the community of true inspiration. In southwest Indiana, on the banks of the Wabash River, George Rapp started the town of Harmony, and it almost immediately became a major commercial center for that part of the country. Similarly, the various kinds of Anabaptists settled in rural areas. Some of these, such as the Hutterites, still prosper in the Dakotas and up into Canada. What distinguishes all of these is that they were Christian communists. The perfectionists, John Humphrey Noyes, who founded the Oneida community, observed that the religiously based experiments lasted longer than the secular ones because they had a spiritual basis which unified them and gave them a core of beliefs. In the late 1980s, the Soviets sent a television documentary team to the Hutterites, who number 35,000 and thus are a substantial group. And they asked the Hutterites, "You make communism and agriculture work. How do you do it?" Indeed, they had done it for almost 500 years. To be sure, the Hutterites have their problems too. A strict biblical and rather patriarchal view of the world, etc. But like anything else human, there will be positives and negatives. One problem of the utopias was that they often depended on a central charismatic personality, when that person died, they tended to give over their communal forms for the private property that prevailed everywhere around them. Even though most of these experiments, quote, failed, unquote, insofar as they no longer exist in their pure form, it's interesting that most of them still exist as active, significant historic sites. I have visited them all around America, at Bishop Hill in Illinois, Bethel in Missouri, the Amanas in Iowa, the Shaker Towns, one at Pleasant Hill in Kentucky is especially splendid, Zor in Ohio, Salem in North Carolina, and New Harmony in Indiana. In each instance, the visitor is able to gain a real sense of what those communities were like, what was so appealing about them. They devoted much effort to making their villages beautiful, that is, aesthetics were at the core of the experiment. In the present day left, that is almost never brought up even as a remote goal. This issue of aesthetics is important because contemporary America is so ugly and depressing. Whether we live in the burnout and rotting inner cities or in the sterile suburbs, we have to do something about the everyday quality of life for people, what kind of environment they live in. Shaker music is more popular now than it ever was before, in part because it is lovely and optimistic and somehow pure. Their furniture is legendary, and originals are high-priced auction items, though reproductions are easily available. The creation of a new society at Amana meant that ordinary members of the community could have inspirations. These were written down, collected, and studied as guides to life. New Harmony contributed much to the advancement of science. The first geological surveys of several Midwestern states were undertaken from there. The town's Working Men's Institute, founded in 1838, still exists as an important art and industrial museum, library, and archive of the rural socialist movement. New Harmony's accomplishments are too lengthy to give here, but practically the entire town is on the National Register of Historic Places. Many of its buildings have been restored and are small scientific, cultural, and historical museums as well. Another aspect of the utopias that remains attractive was how peaceful and productive they were. Everyone worked except those who were elderly or sick. I believe they accomplished so much because they drew together human labor in a cooperative manner. Numerous innovations such as washing machines, clothespins, and the like originated in these utopias. They persist as examples of how such things were actually achieved on American soil. Of course, there were many negative aspects of their experience, too. In spite of the impulse toward peace and unity, there was division and conflict. We should learn from that, too. But to dismiss their achievements as some Marxists do is a major strategic error and ignores an important and still vital aspect of our own cultural history. Achievements can be registered on a micro scale long before they are realized on one that is macro. It's curious that after the collapse of socialism in so many countries, the word community should become almost a buzzword. The market has not quite satisfied every need, every human longing. Even those around the Clintons have latched onto this. Hillary is infamous among rightists for repeating the mantra, "It takes a village to raise a child." There's something about that expression that drives them crazy. They prefer that we all be closed up in little suburban cocoons. And in the same issue, I reprinted a poem by the Los Angeles poet Don Gordon, which deals with this same issue. It's entitled, "We Are Not Ready." We are not ready for the collective. It requires a state of grace, light years from these war cries on the violent desert. The people of the mind live in its cerebral caves. When the door opens on the real world, they hear the night-riding mares. The shell hole neurosis we seek between the dream and the fact. In the debris, in the smoke signals, in chaos, we sleep and imagine the landscape of the commune in its glory, rising with each century and dying with it. It demands more than a belief in our sleep to enter the peaceable kingdom. Or like the young Keats, we may pursue ourselves, a fantasy in glazed ware, around and around an urn and ash.
Well, with that, folks, I want to let you know it concludes our May 1st, 2010 broadcast. Many thanks to John Graham, Professor John Graham, and Dr. Fred Whitehead for giving us their time and their voices. Thank you for the callers. And we're going to finish again as we started with Pete Seeger giving the original French version from the Paris Commune, 1873. Good night, or good afternoon, Pete.
The boule les hommes de la terre, debout les forces de la faim. Dans les entonnoirs sont la terre, c'est l'éruption de la fin. Tout passé est dans ta plage, tout le soir, debout, debout. Le monde va changer la base, nous ne sommes rien, soyons tout. C'est le lieu. Reprends-nous et demain. L'international sera le genre humain. C'est la lutte finale. Reprends-nous et demain. L'international sera le genre humain.
Wake up, you prisoners of hunger. The world is changing at the base. We who have been nothing will be everything. Of the past, we shall make a clean slate. Still speak French, though. He says, it's the final battle. Then he says, we need no supreme saviors, no God, no Caesar. Producers, save yourselves. Heat up your own forge. Soufflons nous même notre forge. Blow upon the forge and make it hot. Beat on the iron while it is hot. Il n'est pas de sorte suprême, ni Dieu, ni César, ni Tribun. Producteur, sauvons-nous nous-mêmes, exploitons le salut commun, pour que le volant de gorge, pour tirer l'esprit du cachot, soufflons nous-mêmes notre forge, battons le fer quand il est chaud, et le lutte finale, groupons-nous. L'international sera le genre humain. C'est le lutte finale. Reprends-nous et demain. L'international sera le genre humain.
Sing all six verses, but it says, the kings intoxicate us with gun smoke. If they insist upon making heroes of us, they will learn that our bullets are for our own generals. Workers, peasants, are we all. The world belongs to everyone. How many feed upon our flesh? But if one day these buzzards, these vultures would all disappear,
the sun will shine always. Ouvrier paysan, nous sommes le grand parti des travailleurs. La terre n'appartient qu'aux hommes. Voici ira loger ailleurs. Combien de nos chasseurs y pêchent, mais si les corbeaux les vautours un de ces matins disparaissent, le soleil brillera toujours. Et le lune finale, groupons-nous et demain, l'internationale.